This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. First up, weird moons of Pluto and koala sexually transmitted diseases. They're among the selected short subjects in science this week. Here with the rest of those stories and more is Rachel Feltman of the Speaking of Science blog at The Washington Post. Welcome back, Rachel.
Hi, thanks for having me again.
Let's talk about the weird moons of Pluto. Why are they in the news now?
Sure. So in July, NASA's New Horizons spacecraft is going to make our first real encounter with Pluto ever. But for now, we have some new images from the Hubble showing really weird behavior in Pluto's moons. So we already know that Pluto's largest moon, Charon, is pretty weird. The two of them are tidally locked. They face a common point and spin around it. They act more like a binary system. But now we know that its other moons, the small ones, Styx, Nix, Hydra, and Kerberos, orbit really strangely, and they're very wobbly. A lot of them are irregularly shaped. They kind of look like footballs that you spun around in a moving car. That's about how how regular the orbital pattern is. And it's probably because Pluto and Charon, because they're this pair, they create a weird gravitational field.
Mm-hmm. And the colors of some of the moons are unexpected, right?
Yeah, so Styx, Nix, and Hydra
are... You're not making those names up.
No, it's Pluto's like moons have great names.
Double play combination.
So they, they're locked in something called orbital resonance. They orbit at intervals that interact with each other, which is what keeps them from spiraling into each other with this, these weird orbits they have. And those three moons in Charon are all very reflective. But then Kerberos, that doesn't seem to have this orbital resonance with the other moons, is very dark. So it suggests that whatever event created Pluto's moons, it was not the same for every moon. And hopefully when New Horizons gets there, we'll find some more moons and figure out what they're composed of. And that should help us figure out how the moons got there.
In about 6 weeks, right?
July.
July, yeah. All right, let's talk about that koala story.
Yeah, so koalas are having a little bit of a problem. They're having a rough time. In addition to not really having enough food to eat, which is leading to Australia culling some of the population, or at least considering it, about 50% of koalas, it's estimated, have chlamydia. It's a different strain than humans get, but it can cause blindness, infertility, and death. And it's rampant. So the practice is generally that when koalas are sick, they're brought in and given broad-spectrum antibiotics before being released. But this research group from UC Davis is raising money to go study what the negative effects of that might be. The reason they're concerned is that when joeys are weaned off of their mother's milk, they eat this substance called pap, which is basically their mother's fecal matter. And the reason they do that is because they need these special microbes to be able to break down eucalyptus. If they don't have those microbes, eucalyptus is toxic. So the concern is that if all of these koalas are being given broad-spectrum antibiotics, their fecal matter might not be passing along the microbes that babies need in order to grow up to be healthy adults.
Wow.
Yeah.
So they do sort of a fecal transplant.
Maybe.
In when they're, you know, so that they can eat.
Maybe.
Wow.
That could be the answer.
Last didn't we talk about pandas and you know, fecal material last time? It's sort of a hobby. We like the biome here on Science Friday.
So we're happy, like the biome too.
When you bring us those those stories. So what's next on your list?
So I covered this study about the practice of placentophagy, which is eating a placenta after you give birth.
Just review that for us, for people who are not familiar.
So it's been around since like the 70s, but it's becoming really popular because a lot of celebrities talk about doing it. One of the Kardashians did it. I think Alicia Silverstone.
You eat your own placenta?
Yes. So
this is like a step from cannibalism.
Well, the thing is that most mammals, most non-human mammals do this. They consume the placenta after they give birth. But it's a little different. They do it immediately. They do it for nutrition. Humans don't need to do that. And most women who do this are having them prepared by midwives or doulas into dehydrated capsules, and sometimes they're taking them as much as a year later. And so a researcher whose patient started asking her about this went back and looked at all the literature and came to the conclusion that none of the studies that are cited as evidence for the benefits of eating your placenta actually show any human benefits for the practice. She also pointed out that no one has done any work looking at the potential risks. And because the placenta is full of lots of bacteria, great for a baby's microbiome, maybe not so great for a woman consuming it. And also heavy metals, because the placenta exists to protect babies from toxic things like that in the environment. So we should really be paying attention to the potential downsides of the practice, let alone whether it's actually good for you or not.
Okay.
Think twice before you eat that placenta.
I think a lot before I eat more than twice. And finally, you have a study about the Triceratops relative.
Yeah, so there's this study about a Triceratops relative nicknamed Hellboy. It has some interesting features, but the reason everybody's talking about the study is not the Triceratops itself. It's because one of the authors, Caleb Brown, snuck a special message into the acknowledgments, which was a proposal. And she said
in the paper that was published.
Yes, in the scientific paper, in Current Biology, I believe. So he asked his fiancée to marry him in the acknowledgments. And it turns out she actually said yes, having read a preprint version of the article. So the actual proposal was not the day the study was published, which was a little disappointing. It seemed like a very high-risk move, but still very sweet. The journal was totally behind it. It seems like this is probably the first time it's ever been done, but I imagine it will become a trend.
That's the ultimate nerdy thing.
Yeah, also a great PR move, but... But, you know, congrats to them.
So don't go to the ballpark and get it up on the big screen.
Just get a...
Publish it.
Yeah, discover a dinosaur.
Did he have to publish the answer also?
I don't know. He may have to submit that.
Well, if you get divorced, does he have to put a retraction out, you know? Kaboom-ba, ching. Yeah. Well, thank you, Rachel.
Thanks, Ira.
That was a great roundup. That Rachel Feldman, she runs the Speaking of Science blog at The Washington Post. Time now to play Good Thing, Bad Thing. Because every story has a flip side. And our story this week has to do with what happened to the dinosaurs. Well, more accurately, it has to do with what happens when you Google what happened to the dinosaurs. Try that. See what you come up with. I'll tell you right now, the top result isn't a scientific explanation. It's a creationist one from a group called Answers in Genesis. So what happens when a search engine becomes the gatekeeper of scientific information? Can it get hijacked? Christina Warren, senior technology correspondent at Mashable, is here to talk about it. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you for having me.
What happened? What happened? You Google that. Why does that come up?
You Google it and you see the result of some very, very clever search engine optimization. So what this Answers in Genesis website has done is they have used SEO tools to put their version of the truth of what happened to the dinosaurs up at the top of the results. And not only is it the top of the results, it comes in what Google calls an info box that answers a question. So Google has, over the last couple of years, increasingly started making it easy for users to type in queries to common questions. You know, what's the atomic number of sodium? What is, you know, 6 times 6? What's the capital of Australia? And it can reveal those answers in an information box. But what happens is that if someone has a political ideology or some other sort of, you know, differentiating scientific opinion, they can game the search engine, as this creationist website has, and put their own version of the truth at the top.
How do you get the other version of what the truth of what's going on?
Right. Well, I mean, that becomes the really interesting question. And so a lot of people, there have been some science blogs who've reported on this and have said, we need to report this answer to Google. And that opens up some interesting questions, which is how much should Google be doing to police the truth, especially with something like what happened to the dinosaurs. It might be very clear cut. But when we talk about scientific issues that might not be decided, it gets a little bit murkier. Frankly, my suggestion, I think that the scientific community should create its own websites with the answer and use the same SEO tools that the creationists used, but to say the truth, and then use their social media power to build its page rank and get the answer on top.
So what's the good thing about this searching stuff?
Well, the good thing is that if it's not for something like what happened to the dinosaurs, this is a great way of finding out answers to common questions. And it's a lot easier to, you know, Google a query than it is to try to search it. And you see that answer instantly, especially if you're on mobile. It's a great way to get instant information.
So you're saying that in order for the scientific community to fight back, they've got to become as proficient.
Yes.
Right?
They need to be as proficient.
In gaming the,
exactly.
gaming the search engine.
I say, you know what? Fight fire with fire. If the creationists are going to fight dirty and create, and frankly, it's kind of cunning. I mean, it's terrible what the results are, but I have to give them credit for being so clever. If they're going to use these tools to their advantage, the scientific community should do the same thing.
Do you think they will?
I hope
so.
They have
the moxie to do that?
They definitely have the talent. I think that if we could find the right people to put their skills in use, absolutely. I just think that this will get the correct answer listed a lot faster than simply asking Google to change the answer.
Because you don't want Google to be in the business of judging everything.
No, right? I mean, that to me, that's actually the more interesting question, which is when do we want Google to intervene? Because it's And to me, the answer should be maybe instead of trying to answer these types of questions, Google shouldn't get involved in those at all. They should be focused on things that are hardcore facts and not things that could be politically argued one way or another.
Mm-hmm. Do you think more sophisticated search engines would be able to do this and not, you know, not take sides? But
I think it's possible, and certainly Google's algorithms could get smart enough to kind of differentiate between what sorts of questions they want to answer and what types of questions they don't want to answer. But I think the difficult thing is that with a query like what happened to the dinosaurs, that doesn't seem that different than, you know, how did, you know, George Washington die, or how old is the Declaration of Independence?
All right, Christina, thank you very much.
Thank you.
To be with us. Christina Warren, senior technology correspondent at Mashables. After the break, Alan Alda is here. We're going to talk about the latest flame challenge. Stay with us. We'll have the results after this break. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. You know, kids say the darndest things. Why am I right-handed? Why does the moon come out during the day? How much does the earth weigh? All those sort of things. So why shouldn't kids answer the darndest things, too? That's kind of what they do when they judge the answers to simple science questions like this year's flame challenge. What is sleep? The 11-year-olds have spoken. The winners will join us in a moment. But first, here to kick things off is the creator of the flame challenge. He really needs no introduction. Alan Alda, actor, writer, director, founding member of the Alan Alda Center for Communicating Science at Stony Brook University on Long Island and advisor to the World Science Festival. Good to have you back, Alan.
Thank you, Ira. So I love talking to you. I love listening to you. I just started tweeting, and one of my first tweets was about how beautiful your program is.
Well, thank you. That's I return the compliment 1,000 times. Let's talk about your program in the Flame Challenge. What was the challenge this year?
This year, the scientists were asked to explain to 11-year-olds what sleep is. And it's interesting that many of the entries included the idea that we don't know as much as we'd like to know about sleep. But, boy, there's an awful lot of fascinating stuff that we do know about sleep that I wasn't even aware of.
Yeah, and so explain the process that goes through now when we have that question.
Okay, so what happens is the kids choose the question, or at least they give us a hatful of questions that we can pick from. Mm-hmm. And when it seemed that sleep was at the top of a lot of kids' minds. So we put that out for scientists to answer, and they can answer either as a video or in written form, short, 5-minute video or 300 words in script. And then it goes to the answers, and hundreds of scientists take part in this each year. And then it goes, after they send in their entries, it goes to a panel to check it for accuracy. Then it goes to the kids to judge. And they actually judge it, and they pick the winner. And it turns out to be a wonderful learning experience for them, because in order to judge the entries, they have to know a little bit about what the entries are saying so they can tell if they have enough information, and then they get to, are they entertaining enough and that kind of thing. But they're very interested in information. They want to know more about this question.
Mm-hmm. Let's bring on the winners. Brandon Aldinger, he won in the text category. There are two categories. One of them is the text category. Congratulations. Can you give us a taste of what you wrote about? Read us a little excerpt, Brandon.
Sure, I'd be happy to. Thanks, Ira.
Mm-hmm.
Your brain is made up of billions of cells called neurons. These neurons are connected in a huge network. While we sleep, our brain strengthens and rearranges these connections to help us remember things more quickly and easily when we are awake. So the next time your mom or dad yells, "Wake up, it's time to go to school," you can explain to them that you're actually still studying from yesterday.
Terrific.
The kids love that joke. I love it, too.
Still studying.
I'm glad they did.
Brandon, do you have any experience communicating this kind of stuff, or were you just going from instinct?
Well, I've blown up my share of hydrogen balloons at chemistry outreach events. I also had a lot of practice doing public observing astronomy clubs, so you get a lot of interesting questions when you're talking about those things to lay people from the community.
Mm-hmm. Let me bring on Eric Galicia. You and your cousin Brian, you went on a different route with a video. I want to play a clip of that, so let's hear some of that sleep video.
What is sleep anyway?
I'm glad you asked. You see, Brian, yesterday you were hard at work. Your brain categorizes things that you learn during the day and generates a lot of cellular waste while it does it. One kind of waste is called amyloid beta, which is a gummy plaque of the brain. At night, when you go to sleep, your brain cleans itself up with something called cerebrospinal fluid. This fluid is essential in cleaning your brain and helps your brain to relearn the lessons it learned during the day. That's why when you don't get enough sleep, like now, I can say, "What did you do yesterday, Brian?" And you will say,
"I don't know. Leave me alone."
I love that.
It's a funny video.
Eric won the Flame Challenge in the video category. He's a Masters of Health Physics candidate at the Illinois Institute of Technology in Chicago. Welcome, Eric.
Thank you.
What was the inspiration for that? Was that a real-life event?
Well, actually, I have a small production company called Kids With No Money Productions, and I've been doing filmmaking since I was very young. And we have our own special breed of comedy between me, my cousin Brian, and my sister, and my other cousin, and we've been making these things forever. So I just kind of did a lot of research on sleep and let it come out through our own crazy kind of comedy that we normally have. So,
how did you get that information that the spinal fluid flushes out the beta amyloid?
Well, I did a lot of research. I want to say I found it out through, I think, Jeff Lipp was his name. I saw a TED Talks presentation. Huh. Is one of the things I looked at. And then I just started researching it more about the cerebral spinal fluid and all the essential processes that happen while you sleep and what diseases it can lead to. And I kind of chose to focus on that instead of REM cycles. There's a lot of information about REM cycles, but I felt like that kind of answered the question, what happens during sleep, and not the question, what is sleep?
Mm. Brandon, Eric, let me ask both of you, any advice you have for people, some of our scientist listeners, for example, on being better communicators?
Sure.
I'll let Brandon go first.
Oh, thanks, Eric. Concise and precise are two rules that really help you to try to narrow it down for your audience. But really, when you're trying to communicate to the public, I find it's helpful to avoid jargon and to use a lot of analogies that help to relate to complex topics to something that people experience every day.
Hmm. Good advice.
For me, I guess I would say read George Orwell's Politics in the English Language and then record yourself and let other people tell you how boring you are until you get good, until they can't say you're boring anymore.
Well, you know what looked pretty important from your video is that you have to have a sense of humor, too, to these.
You both relied on that, didn't you? You both used a sense of humor.
Having a good hook in there that can get people to remember your message is really helpful.
But I always remember but what one young person said at the first year we did this. He said, "It's okay to be funny, but you don't have to be silly." He said, "You know, we're 11, we're not 7." And it makes a big difference to a kid. You know, they're very serious about this, but they do love to laugh, as we all do.
Were you guys surprised that you were chosen?
Definitely. I mean, there were hundreds of people that submitted an entry this year, and there were some really good ones. So to be selected by, I think it was 20,000 students participated, that's a huge honor.
Yeah, that's terrific. Well, congratulations to both of you, Brandon and Eric, and I wish you luck in your careers. You're certainly helping us learn stuff about science. So thanks for joining us this hour.
Thank you, guys.
Right. Bye-bye. Thank you very much.
Brandon Aldinger and Eric Galicia, who won the Flame Challenge this year, one in the written category and one in the video category. Were you surprised how well they did?
You know, each year I'm surprised and delighted. I think one of the things that I hoped would happen, the main thing I hoped would happen was that scientists would get the feeling of what it's like to have to really knuckle down and make something difficult clear to a kid. And what I didn't understand at the time was how much both it would mean to the kids, but how it would turn some of these scientists onto serious communicating of science. Mm-hmm. And some of them are really moving toward that in a big way.
And that's what you do at Stony Brook, right? Teach them how to communicate.
Yeah, we teach them at Stony Brook, and then we're spreading it around the country. We have now the Center for Communicating Science has 9 affiliates now around the country, including some medical schools, and we're starting to travel to other countries and show them our wares.
Wow. I hope you have time for all of this.
I don't know. I shouldn't be here sitting here like this.
Let me give you a little break and bring on another guest. We talked about sleep as a way for your mind to organize and submit memories, and certainly our winners did. And in Eric's video, he explains that sleep is a time when your brain cleans itself. And as luck would have it, coincidentally, just this week, a study came out that suggests there might be a connection between poor sleep and the toxic buildup of the beta amyloid protein in the brain, like he talked about, the protein that has been linked to Alzheimer's disease, which makes you wonder, could a better night's sleep stave off, you know, these diseases? Matthew Walker is professor of neuroscience and psychology at the University of California at Berkeley. He's the director of the Sleep and Neuroimaging Laboratory there, and he's one of the authors on that study out this week in the journal Nature Neuroscience. Welcome to Science Friday, Dr. Walker.
It's a delight to be here.
What did you think of their explanations? Did these guys nail it?
I thought they were exceptional, and it's remarkably intimidating to now come onto the show and try and sort of find the words to communicate my science. I have to say I'm now more than a little bit nervous.
Well, let's let you loosen up a little bit. What does your study show about sleep and the amyloid plaques?
Yeah, so what I think we've discovered here is a missing piece in the puzzle of Alzheimer's disease. What we've known for many years is that the development of that toxic protein that we've spoken about, beta amyloid, in the brain of Alzheimer's patients ultimately leads to bad memory. But what we haven't fully understood is exactly how. How does that bad protein produce that memory impairment? And we've discovered a missing middleman here, and that's the disruption of deep sleep. As both Brandon and Eric delightfully sort of described there, this deep sleep in healthy people is wonderful at hitting the save button on new memories and preventing us from forgetting. But now what we've realized in this new study is that the toxic protein of Alzheimer's disease, this beta amyloid protein, is actually disrupting and blocking the production of that deep sleep. And it's the loss of that deep sleep that is ultimately then preventing your ability to retain the things that you learned across a night of sleep. So it's a missing middleman, as it were, brokering this bad deal between the Alzheimer's protein and ultimately the bad memory.
So the amyloid, it's the amyloid that's preventing you from having the deep sleep?
That's what we've discovered, yeah. So the amyloid is actually accumulating in a very specific part of the brain. And unfortunately, it's the very same part of the brain that is essential for generating that deep quality sleep at night. It also works both ways, though, I should say. This is not simply a one-way street. It's a two-way street of traffic. We know that bad sleep can actually prevent the removal of that toxic protein, just as I think Eric's video describes. So there's a vicious cycle here. If you're not getting enough deep sleep, you are running the risk of not being able to remove that bad protein at night. And the more of that bad protein that builds up, the less of that deep sleep that you get. And so you get this sort of self-fulfilling prophecy, as it were.
You scared me so much with that paper. As soon as I read it, I went out to the drugstore and bought those strips to keep my nose nostrils apart. So I won't wake myself pop up during the night.
And can you imagine what it then does to a sleep research? You know, I become the Woody Allen neurotic of the sleep world. I'm discovering all of these things. And I'm so hypersensitive to my own sleep and getting enough.
I'm Ira Flatto. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. Here talking with Alan Alda and Matthew Walker. You want to keep pursuing that line? You know, does that mean that there are different kinds of quality of sleep? Do you have to get a certain quality kind of sleep for the cleansing to happen?
Yeah, it's a great point, and it's one of the discoveries I think that the field has made in recent years, that sleep isn't just about total amount of time. Total amount of time is important, but it's also about the quality of that sleep, not just the quantity of that sleep too. So I think that sort of revelation is important. I would also say to listeners and to Alan, I know that information is remarkably depressing, as it were, regarding sleep and the risk for Alzheimer's disease, but there is a silver lining here. We can actually do something about sleep in these patients. Sleep is a potentially treatable target, and we now have some really quite fantastic new ways to modify sleep and perhaps boost the quality of sleep, and in doing so, we may be able to salvage some memory functions in these patients. So I think that's the hope for the future.
Is that with drugs or behavior modification or how?
Yes,
I want to hear about this too. Just Alan. We're all sleepless in New York.
Trust me, I'm racing there myself. This is a very selfish research plan I have. So there are drugs that can modify sleep, but we're actually starting to look at non-drug methods. There was a remarkable report a few years ago demonstrating that you can use what's called electrical brain stimulation at night. You apply electrodes to the head, and you start stimulating the brain during sleep as if you're singing in time with those beautiful brain waves. And in doing that, you not only amplify the quality of those sleeping brainwaves, but in doing so, you can almost double the amount of memory benefit that you get from sleep. And so the question now is whether we can translate that same technology, and it's an affordable and portable piece of technology, into those elderly subjects and those suffering from dementia. Can we actually restore the quality of sleep and, as I said, boost back some memory function?
So once the beta amyloid starts to build up, is there not a point of no return? I mean, can you actually start to make it diminish with the right sleep habits, for instance?
So we actually don't know the answer to that incredibly powerful question. It's something that we're now going to start exploring over the next 5 years with longitudinal studies. But what we certainly know is that, firstly, people who are suffering from sleep disorders have a significantly elevated risk for subsequently developing Alzheimer's disease. However, if we intervene and if we treat those sleep disorders, it will actually stave off the ultimate development of memory problems and cognitive decline in later life. So that clinical evidence gives us a few hints to suggest that by intervening and improving sleep, there is some degree of sort of salvation that happens to sort of memory and some protection against the condition of Alzheimer's disease.
And I suppose even if you can hold it where it is, at whatever stage it is, that's at least something.
Yeah, I mean, I think there are ethical questions around that, but certainly I think anything that we can be doing to try and improve the cognition and the memory of patients and even improve their sleep as well, just simply disrupted sleep at night is a major problem for caregivers of Alzheimer's patients. Many people who are caring for patients will know that.
Yeah. We've run out of time. This is just getting good. Yeah. We're out of time. We'll have you back, Alan. Alan Alda is actor, writer, and director, founding member of the Alan Alda Center for Communicating Science at Stony Brook University on Long Island, also keeper of the flame challenge, so to speak. Right. Thank you, Aaron.
Good to talk to you, Dr. Walker.
Matthew Walker, professor of neuroscience and psychology, University of California at Berkeley, director of the Sleep and Neuroimaging Laboratory there. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we're going to talk about Science Club and the sun. Stay with us. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatto. Ah, yes. The Science Club, ooh, heard that one, is in session. Did you turn your body into a human sundial? Did you? It was one of the projects we suggested to be explored over the past 4 weeks as part of our Science Club investigation of the sun. What is it? How do we see it? How does it affect our lives? Gardeners, artists, teachers, heliophysicists, even the Secretary of Energy have all weighed in on what meaning the sun has for them. And joining me now to help finish out the solar celebrations are Science Club founding members, Ariel Zitch and Charles Berquist. Welcome back.
Hey, Ara.
Hi.
Also with us is astronomer Dean Regas. He's outreach astronomer at the Cincinnati Observatory and co-host of the PBS series Stargazers. He joins us from WVXU in Cincinnati. Welcome back.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Dean, we asked you at the beginning of the month, what does the sun mean to you? What does it mean to you?
Well, I took a different approach. I was thinking, you know, I could talk about how big it is, how powerful it is, how much energy it is. And I kind of thought, all right, let's go back to the very beginning. Let's see what the sun did. So I took the approach that what the sun does is it teaches. It has taught us, first of all, very basic from our ancient ancestors about the rising and setting. We watch what a day goes by, what a year goes by. And our ancient ancestors that watched the sky so thoroughly, this was their first diving into the field of science. They found out what the pattern was of day and night and for a year, and that is where we started with our field of science. So the sun taught us.
We want to know what the sun taught our listeners, so we want your sunny thoughts out there. How did you explore the sun? Did you turn yourself into a human sundial and point north? Give us a call, 844-724-8255, 844-SCI-TALK. You can also tweet us at SciFry. Ariel, you've been running this project for about a month. What have you learned?
Well, I just have learned so much. There are all these things that I thought I knew about the sun, right? You go outside, you're like, I've been hanging out with the sun for my whole life. It's always been there. I thought I knew the forces that were important. I thought I knew all of that. But this really blew my mind apart. So I thought gravity and UV radiation were like the primary forces that the ones I should be worried or thinking about. Mm-hmm. Magnetism. Magnetism is a huge deal. The sun, like, sheds it all over the place, and it has a constantly changing magnetic pole, has all this crazy stuff. And so, like, that for me was a big eye-opening moment. But what was really fun was actually learning about the ways that the other things that other people learned, right? So when we do the science club, everybody throws their hat in the rink, right?
Right.
And we had some people that were sharing how they outfitted their entire home with solar panels. We had people sharing how it affects their physiology. Really, it was eye-opening.
And Charles, I kept mentioning about being a human sundial. How did that work? What kind of reaction?
It was really great. This was something that Ariel came up with along with our community manager, Brandon Echter, and a bunch of other creative people in our office. And the concept was that we wanted people to go outside. Needed to be a pretty sunny day, of course, but face north, so point your feet north, and take a picture down of your feet, and then send the picture into us. And Brandon took almost 100 pictures, I think, that people sent in.
You betcha.
And crunched the data and arranged them by time of day, and morphed them all into this GIF of a human sundial, where you can watch the progression of the shadows go around the clock with people's shadows around their feet as the day goes by. It's pretty cool, and it kind of ties in the idea that, you know, the sun is moving around us, and it's a way that people for millennia have chronicled the passage of time.
Mm-hmm. It's up there on our website.
It's on our website right now. You can see it
there. Oh, and which way do the shadows go, by the way?
They go from left to right as you are facing north. So they
go around
you that way?
Clockwise.
Thank you.
Right,
I'm sorry.
Answer.
Clockwise.
That's why clockwise.
This is what happens when you look at your feet in the sun, right? You think it's very intuitive.
Dean, why does that work? Tell us what's going on there.
Well, so we're having this impression that the sun is going around us. This is one of the great illusions of all time, that here the Earth is standing still, it seems like it, and the sun is going around us. We see it rise in the east, set in the west. It moves from where we are from left to right. Your shadow goes from left to right. But it's all because of the Earth rotating. This was one of the big mysteries for our Renaissance astronomers, is what is really going on up there. And they finally figured it out. It took till, you know, the mid-1500s for somebody to figure out, okay, this is all an illusion that the sun doesn't go around us. And unfortunately, we still say sunset and sunrise. We need to say the Earth is significantly rotated so that the horizon blocks it out.
And so
that's a little hard longer.
So that's why the sun, the watch on our clocks go clockwise. The sun goes in that direction, the shadow.
It all goes back to those ancient stargazers.
I never knew that.
Well, that's why I'm here. But now you can also...
clockwise is clockwise.
That's right. It is, because that was our ancient clock. And think about the power of these astronomers that could figure out where the sun was going to rise any day of the year. They could get their king out there and say, okay, king, the sun is going to rise over that pyramid this morning. I guarantee it. And it does. The sun has to obey. I think of the power of those astronomers back then to command the sun, and it had to obey.
Hmm. Let's talk about some of the great submissions that came in, Ariel.
Oh, absolutely. So there were so many. I think, can I categorize them?
Sure.
If I may?
You're the boss here. So,
so the way that people used the sun was surprising. So I think about sun dials, right, as an example of the way people might use the sun, or solar panels. But they were using it for silk screening, so taking photosensitive emulsions, things that respond to UV light and change their properties, to do silk screening. They were using it for baking to help their bread leaven, phototherapy for infant jaundice. People were finding that their chickens lay more eggs in the sun, that sunlight is very critical for chicken egg laying schedules, relaxing, making vitamin D in the sunlight, relief from seasonal affective disorder. So the sun actually, raw sunlight really does play a pretty pivotal role in a lot of people's lives. Maybe Charles, do you want to speak about that?
Some of the ones that really struck me were that there were a lot of people who sent in these great sort of artistic impressions of the sun. I apologize for mangling the name, but Almendra Castillo sent in this image that they had made of basically it was a lens mounted above a big slab of log. And it was mounted on this arm so that the lens was positioned above the log. And for 3 hours every day, for several weeks, they let the sunlight go through the lens and, you know, burn a track into the surface of the log. So it chronicled sort of the power of the sun, and also, this again, the passage of time, because there was this sort of arc traced across the surface of it. Somebody else who does pottery sent in this really close-up image of I don't know what the proper term is, but the granules of this iron-based glaze that they were using to fire their pottery, and compared it to a close-up of an image that NASA had taken of the, you know, swirling surface of the sun.
Right.
And it looked almost identical.
It was,
you know,
so cool.
So people are drawing these artistic connections as well.
We have some callers calling in. If you want to share with us your experience, 844-724-8255. Let's go to Mooresville, North Carolina. Andreas, hi.
Hey, how you doing? Great fan, by the way. Love you guys. Love Fridays because of you guys. We learned this during the transit of Venus. If you take almost any telephoto lens and any camera, we had 4 or 5 cameras running that day, and you use floppy disk as filters, stack them 2 or 3, break them apart till you get the film out of the floppy itself, it makes great, 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 great filter for taking pictures of the sun. You can see spots, you can see whatever you can see in the sun, you can see fairly clearly. At the time we took pictures, you could actually see Venus. So I figure I'd share that with you guys.
Wow.
And everybody listen. Guys, have fun.
Thanks for calling, Dean. And he made his own sort of viewing lenses there.
Oh, boy, that makes me a little nervous when he said that. Because you don't want to use those discs for just putting up to your eyes and looking, staring right at the sun. Those are definitely not safe for optical viewing. But for your camera, I guess your camera could be expendable. I hope his camera was okay afterwards. We'd definitely recommend getting filters that are a little more heavy duty. The ones that I like the best for just staring at the sun are welder's glasses. There's these glasses called number 14 welder's glass. You can put up to your face, stare right at the sun all you want, and it's great. Whenever you go to the welder store, if there's one in your neighborhood, just say you're getting those, and they're going to be like, are you looking at the sun? And we're like, yeah, that's what we're looking at.
Well, Charles, I know that the Science Club sent out a lot of special solar viewing glasses this month, right?
That's right. We shipped out a bunch. There's a bunch still on the way. So
they're in the mail.
Yeah, the eclipse viewers are in the mail, as they say. And we want to say thank you to the folks at Rainbow Symphony for donating a lot of those eclipse viewers. And some of the things that people have been able to see are, I was expecting a lot of, oh, well, we saw this prominence or flare. We saw these sunspots. But Ariel, actually, one of the things that people sort of noticed was that they didn't see.
Right. So, and this is the exact same experience I had. We had a couple listeners who got their solar viewers, looked at the sun and said they were shocked at how perfectly round it is.
Yeah, the disk.
Right? And, yeah, you know, especially amazing. After this challenge, right, because we'd hear all these heliophysicists talking about this, like, you know, this ocean of sloshing plasma and all these prominences and all these things spinning off of it, and you don't picture it as being this perfect sphere. And it's, I mean, it's as crisp and as kind of, it's a really phenomenal shape in nature, right, to see something like that. But the other thing is it's so big, right? You turn your face up to it, it shines light on you, you're getting all this heat, and you're seeing this giant thing in the sky, and it's pretty stupendous.
Dean, are people surprised by how perfectly round the sun looks?
Oh, exactly. I mean, yeah, we kind of get people thinking, okay, all right, they're going to see these flares and these eruptions, but I think they're even more surprised by seeing it, just this perfect circle up there. And it is such a massive star, our sun is, but from our distance, we're 93 million miles away, it is surprisingly small. And that's what I get a lot of people saying, oh my gosh, I thought it was huge, but it's very small when you have the filters on. It only takes up about a half a degree of our whole sky. So you think 180 degrees from horizon to horizon, it's actually looks very small and peaceful when you look through those glasses.
You know, there's a great eclipse coming out in 2017. And that's not too early to start talking about this. And I will. I mean, just remind everybody that this is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. I'm Ira Flatow here talking about the sun. And, you know, because it's going to go right through the middle of the country. And I remember when I was a kid, way back when, before everybody was born, I used to make a pinhole camera to look at solar eclipses. Dean, still a good way to look at an eclipse?
It's still a definitely acceptable way. I think it's a little dangerous in some ways, because I remember as a kid hearing about that too, and I made the pinhole on the piece of paper,
right,
and then I looked through the hole.
Oh,
and
no.
I wasn't maybe the smartest kid, but I got smarter as time went on. But I don't think I think that using these eclipse shades are a lot better, or even better than that. I think there are so many amateur astronomers with awesome equipment that we recommend people hooking up with an astronomy club, because, like you said, we have this great total solar eclipse. It's the all-American eclipse. It's going across the country August 21st, 2017, so about 2 years away from now. Can't wait for that. We also have a minor event called Transit of Mercury coming up. The caller in called about the transit of Venus, which was awesome to see. But next May, May 2016, we'll have Mercury go in front of the sun, which is really tiny. So you're going to need to hook up with an amateur astronomy club to use a telescope to see this little black dot go across the sun.
Ariel, there's been a lot of participation from schools and educators.
Oh,
on
there
this
sure
project.
Has. Absolutely. And, if I can do a few shout-outs. So I asked for an interpretive dance. I got so many interpretive dances from schools.
Dance.
Yeah, absolutely. So we had teachers from Chicago, Illinois. Their students made songs, dances, poetry. Miss Gould's class did a whole unit on videos, poems, with concept mapping, the whole thing. The Miss Shover's kindergarten class, if you go to our website at sciencefriday.com/science club, you can see their Surface of the Sun interpretive dance, which has, you know, complete with solar flares and prominences. It's wonderful. But really, the other thing that got me was the sophistication of experimentation with students. So there were a kindergarten class looking at solar reflectivity of different surfaces. How did they measure it? With temperature, right? So huge shout out to Ms. Shover's kindergarten class. I learned how to do that, which I'd never heard of before. And I think what was particularly cool is everyone did something different,
yeah,
right? You know, there are so many ways to experiment with the sun, to collect data, to interpret its behavior. There's really no limit. Go out and try something, guys.
Yeah. Let's go to take a call, if we have a time for one or two, to Sue in Nome, Alaska. Hi, Sue.
Hi, everyone. Yeah, I live just below the Arctic Circle, and we pay a lot of attention to the sun here. The local radio stations will announce how many minutes we've gained of daylight each day or lost each day. But my husband and I, we paid attention to the sun when we chose our wedding date. As two older people trying to merge different lives and personalities together, we settled on the autumnal equinox because we felt it was appropriate to get married when everything was in balance. Although I do know a couple that chose the darkest day of the year because then they figured that the next day of their marriage would be getting lighter and lighter.
Wow. That's a great way. That's a great way to end our segment on the sun. Thank you very much for that, for sharing that with us.
Thank you.
And just as a last call, if you guys want to go out and do some experimentation, try out the Lawrence Hall of Science DIY Sun Science app. Try our website. We've got activities from all month long from the Lawrence Hall of Science. You can find more information online.
Let me thank everybody from the Science Club, our founding members, Ariel Zitch, our education manager, Charles Berquist, our director. Also, astronomer Dean Regas. He's outreach astronomer at the Cincinnati Observatory and co-host of the PBS series Stargazers. Thank you all for taking time to be with us today.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you, Ira. We'll see you in Cincinnati soon.
We will. There are lots of words used to denote that bright star that supplies heat and light to us. We call it the sun. We refer to it as being in our solar system. But where do the words come from? Howard Markel is director of the Center for History of Medicine at the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor. He's an entomologist, not to be confused with a bug person. Howard, did I get that right? How do you pronounce that?
Well, I'm an amateur entomologist. I love words, yes.
Yes.
But I'm a historian and a physician by profession.
Well, historian, word, history.
Yeah.
Etymologist, E-T-Y-M-O-L-O-G-I-S-T. You're an etymologist, not to be confused with a entomologist, which is a bug person.
No, the bugs creep me out, but the dictionaries are fine.
Well, welcome to the Sci-Fi podcast. Today's word is sun.
Yes.
Yeah? Does it, like many of the words, start with a Greek origin?
Yes, it does. I mean, you can always be successful if you go back to the Greeks. And the Greek god of sun was named Helios. And he was a very interesting fellow. He had an impeccable pedigree. His father was the Titan Hyperion, and his mother was the Titaness Thea. But it was his sisters that really interest me. One sister was Selena, the goddess of the moon, and the other was Eos, the goddess of the dawn. So it's quite an interesting family.
So how do we get from soul to sun? Where's the change occur there?
Well, you know, Helios was around, and by the way, the myth is that he would take his chariot across the sky, and he had fire darting steeds, and as he went from east to west, he would illuminate the world, and then start all over again each dawn. But when the Romans took over the Greek civilization, they used their own language, Latin. And changed a lot of the words. And Helios changed into Sol, S-O-L. And they, too, had many sun gods, Apollo being one of them. But their chief sun god was Sol Invictus, which means unconquered sun. And so for many years, that Latin root, and as you mentioned, still holds for things like solar system.
But the original spelling was S-U-N-N-E, wasn't it?
Well, when you get to Old English or Old German, we have sun. And whether some pronounced it suna or sunna or just sun, but it is spelled S-U-N-N-E.
And so the change to just the S-U-N, how did that come into play?
Well, that didn't happen until the mid-1600s. Now, going back a little bit, sun originally had a feminine pronoun attached to it. She would always be referred to as such. And by the 1600s, sun became a he. So Shakespeare, in his Comedy of Errors, refers to the sun as a he. And there were a lot of English poets like George Herbert who would write devotional poetry, and they loved the play on the word of the sun with the Son of God. And so it became a he. And then after that, by the mid-1600s, it didn't have a feminine or a masculine pronoun. And also by that time, sun was simply spelled S-U-N.
You know, the Greek derivative, the original Helios, is still used around in science describing the sun. We have the heliosphere, the region of space dominated by the sun.
It's also the heliocentric model of how the Earth, actually revolves around the sun. And early on, going back to Aristotle and Plato, they espoused a geocentric model that the sun revolved around us. And they were very powerful thinkers. So that lasted until you know, the great Copernicus, followed by Kepler, and then, of course, Galileo showed that that was not the case.
Well, Howard, you're on schedule, as always, in this International Year of Light we're talking about.
Well, here's a song cue for you. How about George Harrison's Here Comes the Sun?
Well, if we could afford it, we'd go out with that one.
You'd probably have to pay a lot for Beatles songs. You're right. I didn't even think about it.
Thank you, Howard.
Okay, thank you.
Howard Markel, Director of the Center for the History of Medicine at the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor. One last thing. That global warming hiatus turns out to be a myth, an error in measuring ocean temperature and parsing the data. The history, a 2013 IPCC report, revealed what appeared to be a halt in global warming between 1998 and 2012. Climate skeptics jumped on that report, called it a hiatus. They challenged the reality of global warming. But now a new assessment of the data, published in the journal Science, says there really wasn't a halt. And I'll quote from the study, the global warming rate has been just as fast over the last 15 years as over the previous 50 years. Taking into account more refined data, global warming might be worse than the IPCC models. Hiatus, to quote Emily Letella, never mind. And that's about all the time we have for today on Science Friday. I'd like to wrap up the program and thank our Science Friday crew. Charles Berquist is our director, our senior producer, Christopher Taliata. Alexa Lim, our associate producer. SciArts producer is Annie Minoff. Luke Raskin, our video producer. Production assistant, Becky Fogel. Our intern is Ella Fetter. Rich Kim is our technical director. Sarah Fishman, our engineer at the controls here at the studios of our production partners, the City University of New York. You've probably seen that iconic photo of a milk drop splashing to form the shape of a crown. Well, it's our picture of the week. And you can read the backstory at sciencefriday.com/milkdrop. sciencefriday.com/milkdrop. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.